You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Jean Rowley. It's good to have you here this morning.
Thanks, Eric.
So, Jean, the way we start the show is just with, you know, an answer to the question, and this is a huge question, but take it wherever you want. Who are you? What do we need to know about you, your stories or labels or, you know, what's something that can start our conversation?
Okay. I'm a little nervous right now. That's who I am.
Yes. I understand. And I hope, yes.
No, I'm okay. I would say that I am a caring person. I am a mother of two grown lovely boys that are 26 and 30 and out there and doing well. I'm proud of them, and they taught me a lot. I am a wife of a very busy socially, my husband's a judge, so
yeah, yeah.
He's a very, how do I say that? He has a real commitment to, helping the community. I also, am very busy. I've been on boards. I like to give back. I feel like life is awesome, and I'm also an alcoholic that has not had a drink in 26 years. I'm from a family that has been affected by alcohol, so I'm a member of the 12-step community. That speaks a lot about who I am.
Yeah.
That's where I also can give back. I go to four different kinds of meetings a week. One of which is I'm just there so that the teens that have been affected by alcohol have a place to go, and we just my friend and I that are members of the larger group that this is part of, they have to have two adults there, and that gives back to me tremendously. So let's see, who else am I? Yeah. I'm a nurse. I am the eighth child of nine kids, and... my mother is 99, and I love her dearly. Just saw her 2 days ago. She's in a nursing home. I wish I could have her home with me, but she's pretty core.
Yeah.
My dad died when I was eight, so that really shaped who I am. Our family is really quite close knit. We get together with my eight other siblings, although now it's seven because my oldest brother just died in March. I've been PTA president. I've been on the board of Ithaca Community Recovery. That was a while ago, but I feel very dedicated to the mission they have there. And I'm a sister. I'm a wife.
Yeah.
And I also try to just be who I am,
yeah,
whatever, as I show up for the day.
Yeah. When you hesitated at the very beginning, and I saw that look come across your face, and you said, "I'm a caring person." There are only a handful of the 200 people that I've interviewed in this show before who've begun with a personality quality. It's one of the hardest things to begin with, because we often don't claim our own qualities and go on to illustrate them with the relationships, and relationships that come at some cost, as the ones that you've described, you know, good and bad, positive and negative. Jean, it's good to have you on the show this morning.
Thank you.
You brought some music, and you've actually, and you brought a couple of songs that I didn't know, but are really kind of neat. And one of them is Cat Stevens' "Don't Be Shy." Do you want to say something about that before we play it, or let it speak for itself, or after?
Well, I'm one of the other things that I was a longtime Harold and Maude fan, and that's a movie that Cat Stevens has a lot, does the music for, but Cat, this song, I thought it would be good to go first because I don't want to be shy, and in a lot of my work in this life is to be comfortable with my feelings, and so it says, "Don't be shy, let your feelings roll on by."
Yeah, here we go.
Let your feelings roll on by. Don't wear fear, or nobody will know you're there. Just lift your head and let your feelings out instead. Now don't be shy, just let your feelings roll on by. On by, on by. On by, on by, on by. On by, on by. On by, on by. You know love is better than a song. Love is where all of us belong. So don't be shy, just let your feelings roll on by. Don't wear fear, or nobody will know you're there. You're there, you're there. You're there, you're there, you're there. You're there, you're there. You're there, you're there. Don't be shy, just let your feelings roll on by. And don't wear fear, or nobody will know you're there. Just lift your head and let your feelings out instead. No, don't be shy, just let your feelings roll on by. On by, 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 on by.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Jean Rowley. So, Jean, how would you describe, in your telling who you are, you've already told us that you have come through a lot. How would you describe the experience that launched you as a person? Not necessarily the one you are now, but kind of got you through that, got you in that first step out the gate.
The first step out the gate. I mean, I think my father dying when I was 8, definitely, I thought I was an unlucky person or an unlucky kid. So I don't know if launched me in that direction.
But, right.
There was one more after me. She was 5, my sister Patty. But I'd say that what really probably got me going in a positive direction, because there was a lot of lostness prior to that. You know, a lot of great stuff. I've always been fairly outgoing, but lost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being number 8 of 9, you're like, a lot of stuff already happened before I got there. So yeah, it was
And you're going to learn things and go through things and nobody's going to notice.
Exactly.
You're lost.
Yeah. There's one picture of me as a baby, you know, and I'm 1.5 years old, but that's okay. But what really got me going into a positive direction was when our first child was born, and I was partying a lot at that time. I married my high school sweetheart. Uh-huh. We were partying together, but that actually was a huge wake-up call for me. Like, I suddenly was terrified that I wasn't equipped to do this. I'd had 5 miscarriages prior to that, so I didn't really ever really think that I was going to have a child that was actually born.
It's actually going to carry it to term.
Exactly.
You couldn't do that.
And then when it happened, it was like this huge shock, like, oh my God, now what? So that was the first time I asked for help. And, you know, it was just a social worker in a mental health place in Lockport, New York, that, you know, my husband was in school, so something that was really inexpensive, but I was like, that was a huge amount. You don't ask for help. You're admitting that there's something wrong. If there's, and I was, because right almost the minute he was born, I felt like, what it was a huge amount of anxiety. And really, looking back, it was postpartum depression, but it was so much more than that. So that was the first time I asked for help. And then I got through that I was like starting to get a perspective on my life. And then my older siblings were going to a program. They were going to Al-Anon.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying, like, they were telling me things that just didn't seem like that I was from that my father was an alcoholic.
Right.
I'm like, you guys are nuts, basically.
Because you didn't realize.
Normal. Yeah. And he was a very kind, loving man. But he had 9 kids. He worked 3 jobs. And he basically would drink at the table every night. He worked second shift too, but the memories I have are sitting there in his lap and even sipping his beer when I'm a child.
Right.
And there wasn't violence or anything like that, but anyhow, they said they were going to Al-Anon, and I'm just like, how was I even, he died when I was 8, how did that I get affected anyhow, you know?
Right.
And it was really the beginning of my understanding of how, for generations, really, there's been alcoholism in my family, and that it did affect me, which it's taken me, and it continues to take me years to understand how that affected me.
How, can you explain a bit how that has affected you, or and why it took you so long, and takes a lot of people so long to realize?
Well, I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin, because feelings were not, you know, there were only a couple feelings that, you know, it wasn't okay to have feelings, really. I mean, I always felt ashamed if I was crying, my mother was amazing. There was a lot of positive stuff going on, but mm-hmm. There wasn't a lot of supervision.
Right.
My older siblings were looking after me, and, you know, too. And but I didn't know how to. I was scared of my feelings. Mm-hmm. If it was sad, especially. I mean, if I didn't know how to have feelings other than really mad or happy, and there wasn't a lot of gray area.
Right, and there weren't other like curious or right, bemused,
yeah.
Or
yeah. I mean, nothing is absolute, yeah. But I didn't know how I didn't know who I was. And you know, some of that is normal, and not because I'm affected by
and how did people alcohol who are in the household suppress the emotional range?
The emotional, that's a good question.
Skill.
Well, there was. I know that my grandfather, my grandparents came from Czechoslovakia, Austria-Hungary. That it's all switching around right. Over there, but. Yeah. And I know that my grandfather, they did not drink in response to my grandfather's father was like, I think he may have died of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. He would have to go get him at the pub and bring him home and all that chaos and everything. So, and people tend to be caretakers and not really, so that you're thinking more like, oh, how can I fix this situation? How can I help? Because there's no sense of self, really. I mean, because, so I know that my grandmother, when they came here, I mean, they give so much, but there's so much, so there's nothing left for themselves.
Right, and I want to just, let me
try. It's hard to explain.
No, I know. But what you're describing is incredibly important. And when you say there's no sense of self because they want to help, there's the assumption that the other person doesn't have the skill to take care
yes.
of himself.
Yes.
And so you're going to supply what they don't have.
Yes.
And there's also the over time you lose track of what you need.
Yes.
And how to express your yes. own needs and to act on mm-hmm. them as an agent for and of yourself.
Yes.
And when those two things get into real, real extreme, you have a fused, you don't have separate people.
Yes.
They're stuck.
Yes, yes.
They're stuck.
Yes.
And that's how mm-hmm. addiction gets us mm-hmm. stuck. Mm-hmm. But so does the lack of a sense of self.
Yeah.
Which could be addiction, have a role in, but it could just be a person without clear boundaries
yeah.
or without clear. But that's you've just described it really, really clearly, and all mm-hmm. I did was kind of put some accent points
thanks.
On it.
Yep.
How did you? What happened as you? Okay, now I want to go back. When you said the first thing that you did was ask for help.
Yeah.
That is like the first sign that there's a there. You're not just reacting.
Yeah.
You're mm-hmm. not just reacting. Mm-hmm. You are saying I need to do this. I need to do it right. It matters that I do it well. Mm-hmm. And I can't do it by myself. And mm-hmm. I don't know who to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So and the thing about an alcoholic family is also everybody is kind of crawling all over each other to take care of each other
yeah.
in ways nobody really wants.
True.
Or if they do want it, but they don't want it all the time. And nobody's particularly skillful at the dance.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's always going to be a dance of care.
Yes.
But there's, you know, when you have
and then resentment.
Parties. Well, yeah.
Because you've done all this for somebody and.
When it's gone overboard.
But when it's gone when, overboard,
when,
yes.
When, but when it's balanced and that's what you want to raise your child.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You want to raise your child so that you can be alive and be with that mm-hmm. child. I mean, my father died when I was 7, almost 8.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some of the same sorts of issues.
Mm-hmm.
What in you changed when you asked for help?
Well, I started getting a sense of self that wasn't related to what people thought of me or what I was supposed to be doing that I thought other people thought I should be doing. You know, it's like, wow, who am I, basically? And how do I take care of this? I didn't feel present. I never felt really present. I was either thinking, you know, worried about the past, thinking about the future, and not, you know, not really here. And mm-hmm. I wanted to feel like I was here in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that was spurred by having this child that did need me.
And when you went in to ask for help, was it after the child was born?
Yeah.
So you...
I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. My mother came and took care of me. Mm-hmm. I was in like 6 weeks of really just, my mother made me macaroni and cheese, and my husband drove me around, and but I was in a really kind of a constant state of panic. But at the same time, I was very bonded to my child there. I was, oh my God, I was, it was, it wasn't, that's the other thing I've learned. You can have more than one feeling at a time, but I guess the dominant feeling was, at that time, was holy mackerel, only, you know, probably what an expletive in there instead. Help. I don't know who I am and what, now I've got this little being that I'm supposed to raise, and I really felt hopeless. I felt I was it really felt like I was in the pit of a black hole, like in the very of like, and I didn't believe in God. So I didn't have, I didn't really feel like I had anything to reach out to. And it felt like there was this like thick glass. I could see everybody, my husband and everything around me. And, but I couldn't touch them. I mean, it was like they were out there and I was still isolated even though they were right in front of me. Mm-hmm. And so I had to figure out how to, come out of there. And actually I've had a few, I would say that was a crisis in my life. And I've had a few of them over the years, and each time I had to admit that I was wrong, that there, that I, there, you know, I, cause I really thought there's no way out, you know? Yeah. And so each time I'll use the word faith in myself and in, I don't know, I'll say the universe, for, you know, I felt cared. I could trust that I was okay. And that I could trust.
Right.
Somehow along the line there, I didn't have a lot of trust, and I didn't know I didn't have a lot of trust, but.
Right. Well, I mean, when you have a lot of people that are both paying attention and not paying attention to you, and only paying attention to you when you're in desperate straits, you know, then there's not a lot of trust that you've got somebody who's just going to be along with you for the normal stuff. And sometimes we create drama in order to have that sense of connection. But you were able to kind of sit in the darkness and not harm yourself any further, and not harm your child, and move. And wait till something else came, and that is a big, that's a big accomplishment.
It's hard.
Yeah. Shall we cut to music?
Sure.
Do you want to? This is how do you pronounce the artists here?
Macklemore.
Macklemore. Okay.
Yep.
And Ryan Lewis from The Heist.
Yep.
And this is called Neon Cathedral.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about it now or after we listen to Paul?
Let's just play it.
Okay.
One, two, now. Round here, they sing broken hymns. The prayers flow better when they're soaked in gin. The amp's dusty and sits in the corner by a bartender that'll pickpocket your heart and a jukebox that'll steal your quarter. Bartender, please give me a confession. Exchange fear for courage in the form of a well drink. There's a heavy current, got a long way to swim. Closed the Bible a while ago, I need some shots for the sin. Hail Mary, come with me, feel like Pac when it hits. Got some fire in my belly and a ride in the gut. Bushmills for a band-aid, the sweet taste of blood. And I might actually feel something if I don't cover it up. Rusted faces, familiar places. Even if they haven't left the vinyl booth that they stay in. Motel next door, a sign that reads vacant. And a truth that's so strong, I'd be a fool not to chase it. But yet, I'm a fool and I stay here. Hope these problems drown themselves. I die and wait here. One more, four more, fuck it, a nightcap. Service starts at 5 tomorrow and I'll be right back.
Underneath this fragile frame lives a battle between pride and shame. But I've misplaced that sense of pride. This crown of thorns is perched atop my spine. Listen closely as I testify.
Read the Bible, but I forgot the verses. The liquor store is open later than the churches. Pure by the imperfections, everything that's burning. To hell with the confessions, all the Lord of mercies. Blessed than holy water, the scent of Holy Father. Have you ever smelled flesh that sweats out monarch vodka? 11 a.m. in the morning, and you can't get it off ya. Calling to the preacher, but it's like the pastor isn't talking. Until the store opens, I can re-up on that doctrine. The people close to me say that I'm in need of a doctor. Think that I got a problem, but these are not apostles. This is the drink of the Lord, that's according to my gospel. Open to interpretation, if you're judging, I don't want it. I got sins that scold like my throat when I hit the bottle and I'm sinking. And that's why I keep on drinking. I need a refill, far more than once every weekend. Sweet Jesus, I'm getting amnesia. Shaking till I get a taste, my faith is having seizures. Every time I walk away and try to leave it. Every time I walk away and try to leave it. Wouldn't miss it for the world. Baptized in my vices, and the bar is my church. Traded my artist and I pawned off the easel. Spent it all searching for God at the neon cathedral. Wouldn't miss it but the world. Baptized my vices and the bar is my church. Traded my artist and I pawned off the easel. Spent it all searching for God in the young cathedral. In the young cathedral.
Underneath this fragile frame lives a battle between pride and shame. But I've misplaced that sense of pride. Top my spine. Listen closely as I testify. Thief at night, thief at night.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Gene Rowley. Gene, you have had to learn how to be either a new or a different person than you started out. You've had to learn a new way of being, I guess, mm-hmm. is what I'm trying to say. And how does the skin you're in feel? So how does it feel different than the skin you were in when you were 10 or 20 years old? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What does the world look like now that it didn't look like then? And if you can, how did your marriage weather that process?
Mm.
If that's something you're comfortable sure. talking about. Yeah.
Well, I feel safe, and that's been a long process of building trust. And I think that a lot of that is then learning to like myself, and to actually the biggest thing is that I can laugh at myself, yes. and that I had a pretty severe depression after my dog died about 13 years ago. And my friends from the recovering community really helped me through that. And I just remember one time when my friend picked me up and I was really, really depressed and anxious. And we went to Treeman Falls and she's great. Her name's Amy. So we were just yelling into the falls, like pretty much screaming. Nobody was around. It was winter time. So it was winter. Nobody was around. And then...
And you can yell with abandon those things that you feel.
Exactly.
You must. Yeah.
Yeah. And anyhow, at one point we did this really silly thing, and I started laughing, and it shocked me that I was laughing. It was like, and I had to, I couldn't deny that I could laugh.
Uh-huh.
And it kind of, so laughter is kind of big for me. I love to laugh, and I can laugh inappropriately at times, but, and I've always done that since I was a kid, but it's I'm okay with it.
And also when you have when you have limited emotional range to express, sometimes the laughter is just what happens when anything gets too intense.
Yeah.
Any direction.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But so I guess I've learned to not judge myself. I mean, I know that years ago people would say to me like, "Gosh, you're so hard on yourself." And I'm like, you know, and so that interaction with people who were trying to be also be healthy, I could actually like look at myself. And there's so much unconditional love that's offered in the recovering community. My husband and I,
I want to because you said a few things that I really want to go back to, and then you know, I want you to go on where you're going.
Okay.
But your first response to the question was, "I feel safe." And I've learned to trust.
Mm-hmm.
And in this culture, we have the misconception that our capacity to feel safe or trust is dependent on other people's behavior.
Right.
And that's not the historic meaning of trust, which is with hope and faith.
Mm-hmm.
A trust is something that we carry, and we use it judiciously, but it's not because of what others are likely to do, because we have to assess so that we don't blindly walk into something that will harm us.
True.
But we do so, but we're going to be walking in dangerous space.
Yes.
And we know that we are there, fully present and accounted for, to do the best we can. And that attitude towards trust is what lies in ourself.
Yes.
We cannot expect it from other people.
Right.
And so what I was wanting, you having put safety and trust next to each other, your safety is in yourself, and a shrewd understanding of how others can be, but it's rooted in yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's a spiritual self as well, and it's very, very difficult to explain that.
Uh-huh.
But I have, like I said, when I came out of all those little mini crises that I was in. Or I thought I was in.
Sure.
I felt like, wow, I felt cared for in the universe somehow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it is a internal safety.
Right. When you said a spiritual self, that's hard to explain. I'm going to try because this is I tend to try to answer rhetorical questions, which is one of my faults, but. The spiritual self is the sense of one's connection to all other things.
I would say so.
And that's where, I mean, most people use the language of spirituality. They're talking a language of connectedness.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not me and the other, but it's the connection and how we are held in that connection. And if you've only had very bigger than life others in your life, and you felt like you've had to be superwoman or whatever to do that, then you don't have the sense of connection. You have the oversized sense of person.
Yeah.
But when you can trust the sense of connection, and many of those connections are really fragile, but they come through a little bits over time. I think that's what you were getting at.
I agree. I would say that, because it's not religious, and it's not, the God on the throne, and you know, so I always hesitate. I think sometimes words wanting.
Right. Religion is generally viewed as a heavy-handed institutional thing, but the word means religament, to religament, to bind together again that which has been broken apart.
Hmm.
Religion assumes we've fallen off the wagon.
Yeah.
Religion assumes that things have fallen apart, and it's what we do to try to restore them to wholeness.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely, connection is a good way to put it. And yeah, I even feel the connection right now.
Yeah. And you were about to talk about how this process of safety and trust played through your marriage as you were growing.
So we started dating when we were 17 in high school. We met on a history club trip. And although he sat in front of me in some classes, we were young. And he went away to college. I stayed in Auburn, worked at a bar, and my brother-in-law's bar, and went to community college. But we kept the connection. There was mm-hmm. definitely a strong connection there. Mm-hmm. And then we decided to. He decided he needed to take a year off, and so he took off a year from college and went. Sort of to find himself. He went on this big trip to visit. He actually stayed with my sister in New Orleans, and then he went up to Alaska where my brother was. And then he got a job up there. And while he was gone, we decided we would date. But really, that's where I fell apart. That's when my heaviest drinking was. Mm-hmm. I was in nursing school in Elmira. I felt very lost. And then I realized, gosh, I really need him to keep my, you know, he was also partying, but he could keep his act together and I couldn't. He was a very good caretaker. Right, John? We got back together again. And then I went up to Alaska and we decided to get married. So we got married when we were 22. And so it really, really has been a journey, to say the least. I started after our firstborn, Jared was born. I got my act together a little bit, but I was still kind of, you know. And then another sister started going to AA. So I saw a change in her. My older siblings were going to Al-Anon, and I started going to 12-step meetings mm-hmm. when 2 years after Jared was born. And he and my husband sort of followed, and it's been this like gradual awakening to how both of us have been affected by alcoholism, workaholism, all kinds of isms.
Be it all ism.
Yeah, be it all ism. Yeah. So we both got sober together, and then so we're kind of like spiritually. And connected. I almost want to say competitive, because it's like, oh wait, you're ahead of me. I got to catch up. And so it's been a very good match all these years. We've been married 34 years. Right. And so now we even go to a couples meeting, 12-step mm-hmm. couples mm-hmm. meeting, and we really work hard because we're also we're very different. He's very busy. He's got an intense job, mm-hmm. and he cares a lot. So he puts his heart and soul in it. So we're constantly trying to figure out that balance of, because mm-hmm. That can be depleting. And then I'm also involved in a fair number of things as well.
Your list at the beginning of the show was quite long. Yeah.
Yeah. So. We're always looking for that balance, and we work hard together. We have a meeting of two every Saturday morning, and where we, although lately we've been so busy, that's unusual that we haven't had that connection every Saturday morning. But we work hard at it.
Right. And it sounds like, to try to give an image, you went from being overly dependent on each other's presence.
Yes.
To being as implicated in each other's life, but in a way that could be both competitive, but also cheering along,
yeah,
in a whole variety of more nuanced ways.
Yeah, individuals within the coupleship, yeah, too. Like,
so, yeah. Was there a time when that really became clear to you that things had changed?
Let's see. We've been doing that couples meeting for about 10 years, and when did it come clear to me? I guess I'm not sure what you mean by
well,
that.
Well, I guess where you felt like you were not at risk of dragging each other down, but you were spurring each other on, and when you fell back, you were ready to encourage each other to the next step. Sometimes people change, and before you can articulate it, it's a year or two or five or ten before you realize, oh, that began a long time ago, and this is kind of where it is.
I would say this couple's meeting, probably within a couple years of being in there, so mm-hmm. 8 years ago, it was like, wow, we really are, we're different enough that we are, there's a tension there that we can use.
Yes.
And trust. I guess there's that word again. Mm-hmm.
Lean trust, into that lean painful, into, unknown,
yes,
scary place in the other.
And change habits of interacting, really taking a good look at really what this meeting you do in this meeting is actually one of their tenets is that you really look at your family of origin. So we've been on that journey of like seeing, wow, where did we both come from, and why are we together, and how does that complement, and where does that challenge us?
Right.
Which is a lot of challenges.
Where does it give us the comfort of the past, but also the dangers of the past?
And yes.
Where does it give it the challenges that we wanted to look forward to in each other that are going to take us away?
Or like, there we go again. We're in that pattern that is from our family of origin, that is so old, and that we're just, and then we're in that little trap, and to become aware enough that we can step out. And that's not easy.
It's very funny. The next song on your list is Ode to Billy Joe, which is a bit about a trap.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can we play that?
Yeah, sure.
And we'll take a little break here with this song.
Sleepy, dusty Delta day. I was out chopping cotton and my brother was baling hay. And at dinner time we stopped and walked back to the house to eat. And Mama hollered at the back door, y'all remember to wipe your feet. And then she said, I got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today, Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. And Papa said to Mama as he passed around the black-eyed peas, well, Billy Joe never had a liquor since. Pass the biscuits, please. There's 5 more acres in the lower 40 I got to plow. And Mama said it was a shame about Billy Joe anyhow. Seems like nothing ever comes to no good up on Choctaw Ridge. Just jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. And brother said he recollected when he and Tom and Billy Joe and put a frog down my back at the Carroll County Picture Show. And wasn't I
ride. I saw him at the sawmill yesterday on Choctaw Ridge. And now you tell me Billy Joe's jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Mama said to me, child, what's happened to your appetite? Today said he'd be pleased to have dinner on Sunday. Oh, by the way, he said he saw a girl that looked a lot like you up on Choctaw Ridge, and she and Billy Joe was throwing something off the Tallahatchie Bridge. A year has come and gone since we heard the news about Billy Joe. Brother married Becky Thompson, they bought a store in Tupelo. There was a virus going round, Papa caught it and he died last spring. And now Mama doesn't seem to want to do much of anything. Choctaw Ridge, and drop them into the muddy water off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Gene Rowley. And that was Ode to Billy Joe and Bobby Gentry's 1967 hit, which I remember from my childhood very clearly. What about that song? What do you connect to in that song?
I think I can connect to the singer, the main person there, the narrator, I guess. Her invisibility at the dinner table when something is so tragic. Obviously, she was connected to Billy Joe, and mm-hmm. in their, you know, saying things like, you know, yeah, pass the peas, and yeah, he never amounted to much, and she's just like, why aren't, you know, and the mom tunes in a little and says, why you seem to have lost your appetite, you know, and that's about as far as
right.
it goes, right. And just, yeah, so, and that's
that numbness.
Yeah, numbness.
It's the numbness.
Yeah. And there's so many tragedies now that, I mean, how can we take in all that's happening in this world? But on the other hand, we're all so busy that I should say. It's hard for me to feel like, wow, there's so much going on.
Right, and but again, I think the temptation is to want to try to kind of feel it all fully.
Yeah, it's possible. Impossible.
And that's kind of impossible. But how do we remain open to what's happening?
Yes.
And so that we can then choose to go more deeply if we have time mm-hmm. or emotional mm-hmm. space, and how can we kind of choose. How can we walk through this thing called life where there are shelves of horror and there are shelves of wonder and there are shelves
yes.
of beautiful and satisfying and disgusting but necessary things that we have to do? And how can we just be in that place mm-hmm. and take of them and give back to them without feeling overwhelmed or without feeling like we're over, more competent than we really are? How can
yeah.
we be humbled and also hopeful?
Yeah, I'd yeah. say so, yeah. yeah.
And I'm rambling and I'm preaching on a Sunday morning.
You're fine. I actually agree with that.
So how have you, what kind of an environment did you try to create for your boys to help them kind of walk through the awareness that you were coming into as a parent and they were living into as growing children, and how has that, you know, how do you see that as having changed your life and changed their lives or your relationship with them?
I guess I strove for a shame-free environment that, you know, my son, Jake, actually wrote to my own horn here a little bit, but he wrote it. He was at Harvard School of Education, got his master's a couple of years ago now, and he had to write an essay on a moral mentor, and he chose to write about me, and it was like unbelievable to read that paper that he handed in to Harvard, because he kind of validated that it was a shame-free upbringing, that in that we figured out ways that were consequences for his behaviors that, you know, we talked about ahead of time, and the other thing is, the first line in there is that my mother has been a member of, I can't really say, the 12-step, you know, two 12-step programs for a quarter of a century, and this has, and basically he could see how that affected him. Mm-hmm, he saw me, he's, you know, he talked about me talking to people on the phone or people coming over, and also just feelings were okay to talk about.
And you lived a lot, and what I'm going to infer here is that you found a way to live a life that addressed your demons without handing them off directly to him, and that also showed that struggle to him so that he could appreciate it without having to live it.
Yes. I would say, yeah, and he's still, like, our younger son, his name is Jake anyhow, he took the hard way of not using drugs or alcohol, and he knows it's the hard way. I mean, it was hard, but it was less hard than using, that's for sure. But
he chose it.
He chose it, and he still chooses it. And so you're dealing with life straight on. And then you develop the skills to cope, because you have to ask for help, and you have to find it within yourself, how to deal with all the social anxiety of growing up and all of those challenges that I know that I took the easy way, as far as, you know, it was harder in the long run, but of being a party girl, just for lack of a better way.
Right, or reaching for a bottle, or reaching for
numbing out.
And a party girl is also numbed out.
I mean,
you're a fixture that other people observe, and you perform, you know.
Yes.
You know, so it's
kind of one-dimensional.
Right, and you allow yourself, but you came to the point where you weren't going to be that anymore.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is Jake had decisions that wouldn't allow one dimensionality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he struggled.
Yeah.
And so, and Jared too. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I want to kind of close the last few minutes of the show out with, what do you do to restore your sense of balance, optimism, or strength? And we've already covered some of these in the big crises things, but I'm really concerned more, what do you do on a day-to-day basis? You know, daily, weekly, monthly, or throughout the day? And how do you know you need to take care of yourself?
I have been really trying to practice meditation every morning. The last couple of months have been a little crazy. We've been traveling almost every weekend for weddings, all good stuff. Mm-hmm. But we have four dogs. I love to walk the dogs. We have woods behind our house that is so restorative to me, to just take them and walk out in the woods, snuggle with I have a little Josie dog that's she's just a snuggler, and I find a lot of comfort in animals, and I knit. I read. I joined a book club. I make soap, which I gave you a bar, and I love to do crafts. I love being creative, reading. One of my favorite things is just to be home and putter. Mm-hmm. I call it puttering, where I can just, there's no time constraint. I can just, okay, I'll do the dishes, and yeah, I'll throw a load of laundry in, and maybe I'll even look at this magazine, or, you know, and it's actually a struggle to not feel like I should be doing something all the time. And there's always something to do.
Right. But the thing is with puttering, because I'm a putterer too, mm-hmm. but with puttering, you're doing stuff,
yeah.
but the pace is never rushed.
Yeah, it's kind of meditative.
And well, that's the other piece, is it meditation, because you're merely kind of observing the next thing and doing it and letting it be done,
yeah.
and the next thing. But it cannot be rushed. And the minute yeah. it's rushed, it's no longer
mm-hmm.
puttering, and it's no longer restorative.
I guess I really hate to be rushed. And I know my mother was that way too.
But, 9 kids.
Yeah, 9.
Yeah, yeah. She was rushed a lot.
But she would go slow. She would drive us crazy, because she would like be looking. She'd be like, "Oh, look at this flower," and we're like, "Wait, we're gonna be late for school or something." I don't know.
So she had a capacity to step out of her circumstance.
Yeah.
And look at something.
I think she separate. Did it intentionally, right. like for her sanity.
And is that how was that one of the reasons why so many of your siblings so early could pick up on the 12 steps, because they had maybe seen a little bit of that? Or
My mother is amazing, even though in all the craziness of the family
sure.
and everything, there's something really my mother was. She was wise. She lived in Brooklyn. She went to Pratt, so none of her siblings actually got any college. But she was a dietitian, we ate. You know, we didn't eat a lot of junk. I did have a sense of being home with her.
Yeah.
It's hard to describe my mom, but everybody loves her. She's yeah. Everyone loves her in the nursing home too. My husband loves her.
Yeah. So. This is good. Jean, it's been really good to get to know you.
Thanks.
Thank you. And you want to close with Imagine, John Lennon. Do you want to say anything, or just let it speak for itself?
It really speaks for itself. I mean, imagine. Yeah. There's no religion. I mean, just... awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Imagine there.